Hey, everybody. We're live in the bunker here, somewhere hidden in Las Vegas. I'm squatting at a house. You'll have to figure out where. But yeah, this is your Disrupt TV Green Room. We're going to introduce our guests, always. We've got my amazing co-host, Bala Afshar, and of course, Elle, our great producer. And of course, we're going to introduce our guests, and we're going to ask them where they're coming in from today. And of course, what are they talking about? Michael, where are you coming in from? What are we talking about?
I am coming in from Reston, Virginia, just outside of DC, and we're going to be talking about open source intelligence.
All right. Very, very important topic as things are happening right now. Guy, welcome back. What are you talking about? Where are you at? So
I'm going to talk about how to make a difference and be remarkable. So open source remarkability.
Very cool. And are you in California today?
Yes, I am. Well, California is a state of mind, but yes, physically, I am in California.
Ah, very, very cool. All right. Okay. I'll do some checks, test some things, and let's turn it back to you, Al.
All right,
3, 2, 1. Welcome. Thank you for joining us on Disrupt TV. My name is Bala Afshar. I'm the Chief Digital Evangelist at Salesforce and your co-host for the next hour. We welcome you to follow us on X at Disrupt TV Show. Send your questions live to Ray, myself, our distinguished guests, and we'll do our best to answer them in the next hour. It's my pleasure to introduce my co-host, Ray Wong. He's the CEO, founder of Constellation Research. He's the best-selling author of Everybody Wants to Rule the World. I see him on TV just about every day, Fox Business, Yahoo Finance, CNBC, Bloomberg. In my humble opinion, he's one of the top futurists to follow on X at RWANG0. Welcome, Ray Wong, to Disrupt TV.
Hey, thanks a lot. I'm here with Bala Afshar, the Chief Digital Evangelist for Salesforce. He's also the author of multiple books, including his latest one, Boundless, which is a new mindset for unlimited business success and a number one seller on Amazon. But you know that. Executives around the world, they check him out all the time. His inspirational keynotes, innovative tweets, and of course, very, very inspirational conversations. And when he's not hosting, keynoting, or hosting events at Salesforce, you can find him on business TV outlets like Bloomberg, and of course, writing inspirational, insightful posts as well on ZDNet. But it's not about us. It's about some amazing people that we bring on every week onto the show. Who do we have to kick off today's episode?
What a pleasure for you and I and our audience. We have the OG evangelist, Guy Kawasaki, his chief evangelist at Canva, former chief evangelist at Apple, former trustee at Wikipedia, author of 16 books, Ray. You know why you and I have imposter syndrome. And we're going to talk about his latest book, Think Remarkable, 9 Paths to Transform Your Life and Make a Difference. You want to read this book. You know, why do some people seem to eat, sleep, and breathe awesome? Guy's here to tell us how. Guy is the host of Remarkable People podcast. And this book is a culmination of 250 interviews, 5,000 page transcript, which Guy reduced to about 170 pages and 88 tactics, which makes this book truly remarkable for those like myself that can only read one or two pages before we lose our attention span. Guy is an executive fellow at House School of Business, UC Berkeley, adjunct professor at University of South Wales. He was a chief evangelist at Apple, as I mentioned. He has written, as I mentioned, 16 books. Art of Enchantment is one of my favorite books of all time. Now, Guy probably doesn't know this, but when I launched my podcast, my first episode in 2013, Guy was my first guest.
Really? Wow.
In his book, he talks about growth, grit, and grace. And I want to give you an example of grace. Because when I asked Guy to be my first guest on my podcast, he didn't know me from a hole in the wall, and he said yes. To this day, I don't understand why he would agree to be on a stranger's podcast. But that led to me writing more for major publications, growing my social network, and I was the first evangelist hired at Salesforce. I'm the chief evangelist at Salesforce. Guy being on my first episode, I believe, paved the way for me to join Salesforce as its first evangelist. He doesn't know this, but talk about the best example I can give of grace. Grace. I have no idea if he does this today where he bumps into random people and agrees to be on their podcast, but grace. Anyway, you can follow Guy Kawasaki at Guy Kawasaki, and please follow Guy because he's got over 5 million people that follow him, like myself and Ray. Welcome, Guy, to
this. Thank you. Geez, I just want to know, do I have to talk like you guys? I'm going to have to like say, okay, my name is Guy Kawasaki, and I was chief evangelist of Canva, and now I'm writing a book, and this book is called Think Remarkable, was 9 Paths to Transform Your Life, and I'm going to do it for you. So that's how I did it.
Guy, I had to reduce your bio to less than a minute so we can have as much time with you as possible. So you've done a lot in your life. Yeah,
maybe we should start off with a great story about Mark Benioff, since you're the chief evangelist of sales.
Oh, wow. This is the only you're probably one of the few people that can punk him.
But please be kind. Please be kind. You know,
I'm telling you, this is a job. This may be a career-limiting move for you.
I'd love to hear. But for those of you who may not know, Mark's first job as an intern in the world of tech was because of Mr. Kawasaki. So that's please right. tell us.
This is all a true story. So Mark had just finished his first year at USC. That's the school that people who can't get into Stanford go to. So anyway, so this is after his freshman year, and he applies and he gets a job with us at the Macintosh division. We hired him to write assembly language sample programs so that people who are coming to the Macintosh platform learn how to write assembly language programs, and he's going to write examples. So Mark is, shall I say, a big, tall, you know, well-endowed person. And he's from Hillsborough, California. And Hillsborough, for those of you not familiar, is a very wealthy area near the San Francisco airport. Kind of like the Beverly Hills of the Bay Area. And so because Mark, you know, was like this big, tall, you know, heavy set, very fair complexion person, behind his back, we used to call him the Hillsborough Doughboy after the Pillsbury Doughboy. And, you know how you get this first impression of somebody. So, like, in my mind, Mark Benioff equals Hillsborough Doughboy. Now, you know, 35, 40 years later, he's the freaking billionaire. You know, he has the biggest building in San Francisco. You know, he's, like, given $250 million to UCSF Medical Center. You know, he probably has a Gulfstream and all that. But in my mind, I still think of him as the Hillsborough Doughboy. I just can't get that image out of my head.
So, Guy, a lesson from this is be nice to the interns.
That's right. That's right. Like I tell people, I'm one for one with interns. I had one intern, and he turned out to be a billionaire. So, you know, my record is perfect.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Well, thank you for the story.
As we go from being average to remarkable, and you really tied this back to some of the original branding campaign at Apple, from Think Different to Think Remarkable. What led you to do that? Why bring the connections, tie it all back?
Well, this is a moment that, you know, I'm not necessarily a good lesson for people, but this is how the story goes. So this is 1997. Apple was supposed to die. And so if you were using a Macintosh in 1997, you were thinking different. You were not thinking standards of MS-DOS or Windows or something like that. You were, you know, so the ad campaign featured people like Nelson Mandela and, let's see, Amelia Earhart, Albert Einstein, you know, Picasso, some people you may have heard of. And the gist of it was that if you think different, you can be like this. You can be like a visionary. You can be a famous person who makes a difference in the world. But if you're thinking the same, then, you know, you're just going to be great unwashed masses. So anyway, this ad campaign is introduced to us by Lee Clow of advertising of Apple's ad firm. And he's in this room with me and Steve and about 8 other marketing executives. And At the end of this presentation, which we just loved because it truly captured the spirit of a Macintosh user and an Apple employee thinking different, Lee Klaus says to Steve, I got two copies of these ads. I'll give you, Steve, one, and I'll give one to Guy. And Steve says, don't give one to Guy. And I spoke up. I said, what's the matter, Steve? Don't you trust me? And Steve, as only Steve would, he says, yes, Guy, I don't trust you. Now, with hindsight, you know, you think about it. This is one of those man or mouse moments, right? This is one of those moments you're going to look back and say, why did I wimp out? Why didn't I come right back at him? You know, because this is like a pivotal moment in your like self-image, right? So I got to tell you, man, I bellied up to the bar and I like swung for the fence. And I said, Steve, that's okay because I don't trust you either. And so that probably cost me, I don't know, 100 million in stock options. But hey, what a great story. It was worth it.
That's remarkable. That is a remarkable story. Guy, 250 interviews with truly remarkable people, people like Jane Goodall, people like Stacey Abrams. What is this gravitational pull? How do you get these amazing people? Of course, it's you. advice to junior podcasters like Ray and I. What makes a remarkable conversation? How do you get to a place where you folks want to speak with you?
Well, okay, this is going to take a while to explain this story. I don't know how much time we got.
No, but, please go.
Okay, no, but, so I'm from a lower middle class part of Honolulu, Hawaii. So, you know, it's not like I was born in Mar-a-Lago in Hawaii. Okay, so I come from a lower middle class family. And I went to a public elementary school. And in elementary school, my sixth grade teacher told my parents to pull me out of the public school system of Hawaii, put me into private school system because I had potential to go to college. Thank you, God, my parents listened to her. Thank you, God, my parents were willing to make that sacrifice. So I got into that private school. That led to me getting into Stanford. Getting into Stanford led me to meet somebody named Mike Boych, who a few years later hired me into the Macintosh division, despite my lack of educational or work experience relevance. Okay, it was pure 100% nepotism that I got into Apple. Now, at Apple, I happened to do quite well, and I became very visible. So fast forward a few more years, and I get this email out of the blue that says, Jane Goodall has accepted our invitation to speak at TEDx Palo Alto, and we would like you to interview her on stage, right? And I'm like, nice. Oh my God, this is, you know, this is like, what could be better than interviewing Jane Goodall, arguably the most remarkable person alive in the world today, on stage for TEDx? So of course I accept, and Jane and I become good friends. I went to her birthday party a couple of weeks ago in San Francisco. She's now 90, and just FYI, she's 90 years old. She travels 300 days a year.
My goodness.
I travel 5 days a year and I can barely handle it. Okay. So Jane and I are good friends. And so when I was starting my podcast, I'm like, who could I start this podcast with? And, you know, I guess Jane Goodall is to me what I was to you, in a much reduced manner, but anyway.
No, to me, it wasn't much reduced at all. You're a legend. No.
So anyway, I get Jane Goodall for my first episode, right? And then I got to tell you, I am often a podcast guest as opposed to host. And I know my thought process, and I know the thought process of many people who are asked to be on a podcast, which is the first question you ask is, who else has been on your podcast? Right? Because if you ask somebody who else has been on your podcast and they say, oh, it was Joe Blow of Blow Consulting, and he just wrote a book called The Blow Way. You're thinking, why would I go on a podcast with Joe Blow from the Blow Way book? So now, you know, when people ask me, well, who else has been on your podcast? In my second week, I was saying, well, you know, I had Jane Goodall. Perhaps you've heard of her.
Drop the mic.
So you get, you know, so now you get Jane Goodall. That helps you get Margaret Atwood. Atwood gets you Steve Wozniak, and Steve Wozniak helps you get Steve Wolfram, and then you get Angela Duckworth and Carol Dweck and you know, Bob Cialdini and David Acker. And then pretty soon, you potential guests don't ask anymore.
Amazing. But wait.
The moral to this story, and seriously, is that, as Steve Jobs said, you can only connect the dots looking backwards. So I can connect the dots from me having Jane Goodall writing the foreword of my book to a sixth grade teacher in Kalihi Valley, Honolulu, Hawaii, telling my parents to put me into a private school. Wow. That's how the dots worked. And, you know, there was, listen, if you think back at Kalihi Valley, in the 60s or 70s, we were planning, you know, someday my son is going to invite Jane Goodall. So we have to like connect all the dots going forward and make sure that he gets to her in the next 30 years. Nothing like that occurred. So my message is, you can only connect the dots looking backwards. And the other thing is, you always say yes. You default to yes. You just keep saying yes and you figure it out later.
Unbelievable. Thank you for defaulting to yes to a stranger 11 years ago. My entire career trajectory changed because of that random kindness.
No, I don't understand. but you know, I mean, seriously, so I really do believe in defaulting to yes. And I'm on this book tour right now for Think Remarkable, and they have a... they have a PR firm working with us, Fortier, you know, this PR firm.
I love Mark.
You know, most times when you have an author, they ask the author, well, who will you say yes to? You know, what's the minimum number of subscribers? Who do you want their target market to be? Blah, blah, blah. And in our first meeting, I said, say yes to everybody. I don't care if it's an esthetician's podcast about how to look beautiful. You just say yes, because that esthetician's audience, the spouse might be the CMO of Salesforce or the CMO of Procter & Gamble, or it could be the, you know, Secretary of Education who's going to learn about Think Remarkable and then make everybody in the Department of Education read my book. And that means every superintendent reads my book, which means every principal reads my book, which means every teacher reads my book, which means every parent buys the book for their students. And bada bing, bada bang, by saying yes to the Estheticians Podcast, you're a bestseller. That's my theory.
This is why millions of people connect to you. Millions of people connect to you because of your generosity that's observable. It's not just talking about being kind or being available or accessible.
We should ask him to come to our conference at this rate.
I'm telling you, now that we know you default to yes.
Where and when is it?
October 29th, Moon Bay. It's a far commute for you, you know. I got to go up the beach maybe.
It's in where?
Half Moon Bay Ritz. Every year.
Half Moon Bay Ritz. I'm there. No problem.
October 29th. All right, we got you. But hey, let's talk
about... No problem.
We've got you there.
How many people come to this?
200 CXOs.
300 people, yeah.
Okay. So my deal is I will come to that. I need a hotel room overnight, and I want you to buy one copy of Think Remarkable for everybody. That's my deal.
Done.
Shit, I should have asked for more money. Something's wrong. It's too easy.
No, we will give you two guests, three hotel rooms. No, it's kidding. We would be happy to have you there. So I would set it up.
It would be amazing.
I'm gonna learn how to play bagpipes so I can play bagpipes at a Ritz Carlton guy.
That's every night. That's right. So,
I gotta go buy a skirt later on today.
Let's talk about ikigai. What's guy's ikigai? And you can explain the Japanese word for ikigai.
It's actually Okay, before I explain what ikigai is, I thought of getting the license plate IKIGUY. I mean, wouldn't that be funny, huh?
I looked for it actually. You have to go on the DMV site, right? And it's taken. You have to like leave a space, but it is available actually.
So, ikigai is available.
Do it now.
That's a little too like ostentatious even for me. But anyway, ikigai is a Japanese word, and it's roughly translated into sort of your meaning of life, the reason why you get up every day. And I'm not saying that's for billionaire hedge fund managers. What's your ikigai? Oh, exploiting the capitalist system. That's not what I mean. I mean, when typically when they cite examples of ikigai, they show like some 90-year-old guy in Japan who like makes the best samurai swords, and they show him, you know, they go up to this special mountain and he digs the mountain's iron ore, then he takes the iron ore, takes it to his furnace, and then he's like melting it, then it comes out as metal, and then he's pounding it 2,000 times, putting it back in the heat, pounding it, then it sharpens it, and it takes, you know, 5 days just to make the wooden handle and all that, but he makes the best swords in the world. And that's what your ikigai is. When, you know, what's the equivalent of you want to make the best samurai swords in the world? And in my book and in my podcast, I interviewed Mark Manson. And Mark Manson is the guy who wrote The Subtle Art of Not Giving a, you know what. And that is a brilliant book. And he told me, Guy, you know, you will know that you have found your calling when you enjoy and love the shit sandwich that your calling requires. And I thought about that, and that is so true. So, you know, as a podcaster, you know this, right? So there's a lot of shit sandwiches in podcasting. You got to do the background research. You have to do a lot of audio editing. There's a lot of steps in podcasting. It's not just look the guy up in Wikipedia, turn on the mic and go, right? So it's a lot of shit work. And as an author, there's even more shit work because you got to edit for months and months and months. So from the outside looking in, you say, you know, why do you do this? Why do you do all these shit sandwiches? There must be an easier way to make a living. But when you find that you love editing or you love the prep for a podcast, you know that you found your ikigai. So you could be saying to the guy making swords, well, why do you spend weeks and weeks pounding that piece of metal? I mean, surely you have better things to do, play with your great-grandchildren or something. Why are you pounding that metal for 2 weeks? Well, that's his ikigai. That's the shit sandwich that he loves. And I think that's a very important concept to being remarkable.
We both agree. This is episode 360, and we've interviewed over 1,300 people over the last 8 years. And it's,
wow.
I can speak for Ray. This is my favorite part of the week, because folks like yourself come here and we can be students for an hour and try to learn as much as we can. And you've already expanded my mind in the first 10 minutes. So that's definitely our ikigai.
Hey, Vala, have a request of you. So over your left shoulder, there's a book with Mark Benioff's picture on that. I want you to put my picture there. Oh, my God. Jeez. Like,
I will do that next episode. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Unless the topic of your podcast is, you know, how to be a remarkable intern. I mean, let's upgrade your background there.
That, again, this is why you're the OG evangelist and I'm the rookie. This is a learning moment for me for sure. One of the previous guests we've had, who's also expanded my mind, and I had the privilege of writing the foreword for his last book, was Tom Peters.
Oh, yeah.
And seminal management thinker, Tom Peters. And my question to you is, his advice has endured fads and test of time. And I'm asking you this because I'm looking forward to sharing your comments with Tom. Tell
when
us about
is Tom?
We've had Tom on the show several times, and we're in the process of having him on the show again. But one of our favorite episodes, we had over 200,000 people tune in when Tom was on Disrupt TV. So he's amazing.
200,000?
200,000. Yeah, views, absolutely. Yeah. So right. our network loves Tom as well. Tell us about Tom and why he's a remarkable person.
Oh, well, listen, Tom, you know, I think Tom to me, you know, the giants of management books are Peter Drucker and Tom Peters. Basically, that's it. And Tom Peters, In Search of Excellence. Maybe you could put Jim Collins in that category too, but Tom Peters, In Search of Excellence, that was a monumental accomplishment. And it just like, it just changed the sort of philosophy of American management and American business about not just making a quick buck and not doing, you know, quick turnovers and not selling your soul, but, you know, doing something excellent. So, you know, he owns the word excellent, and I hope to own the word remarkable. So he's actually, he was on my podcast, and he is in this book because one of the things that he described in his podcast, which I found very interesting, was that He loves Zoom. Yeah. You ask him about this. He had this whole thing about MBWA, right? Management walking by walking around, right? But now it's MBZA, which is management by zooming around. And I tell you, there were two people out of 250 people on my podcast who said that Zoom has improved their ability to impact people. Tom Peters, because he said, you know, with Zoom, if you have a worldwide, you know, workforce, you can only fly to your, you know, your office in Croatia once a year or once every 2 years. But with Zoom, you can be there with them at any time. And so you got to stop looking at it like, oh, it's, you know, it's only one dimensional. It dehumanizes, you know, it's not person to person contact. Yeah. I mean, that's the glass half empty. The glass half full is, man, you can reach out to those people in Croatia and, you know, Quito and, you know, I don't know, Shanghai, anytime you want. So I love that management by zooming around. And so he's in my podcast and he gave me a great quote for the book. And so, yeah, he's the man. He is the man.
He definitely is. Well, hey, thank you for sharing that story.
Short of teleportation, right? Like, what would you do? Zoom gets you there. So now I'm going to switch topic back to Steve Jobs. We talked about asshole leaders. What kind of asshole leader is Steve? Hey, I live in Cupertino, so I want to know.
maybe we should go to 99 Market together, but that's a different subject. I'm more of a Mitsuha guy, kind of guy. But anyway.
You know, them by the Mitsuha is still pretty good. So.
You know what? I think I'm trying to pitch my friends. They think I'm nuts, but I think that you could make a restaurant that's like a musubi bar. So it's not a sushi bar. It's a musubi bar. And you walk in and there's chefs behind and you know, you can only order musubis. And it seems to me that a musubi bar, because there's so many taco places and poke places and all that, but there's no musubi bar. And if you think about it, musubis, what do you need? You need nori, you need rice, and you need furikake, and you need ume. None of those things are going to be like spiking in prices. Whereas ahi, God help you, you know, ahi could be $5,000 a pound tomorrow. Now, where were we? What were we talking? Assholes. Okay. Listen, so I've been in Silicon Valley for about 40 something years, right? So I am an expert in assholes. And I don't mean in the proctological, you know, upper GI sense. I mean assholes in terms of character. So I have figured out that fundamentally there are two kinds of assholes. One asshole is the ego-driven asshole. It's all about me, myself, and I. Am I not the most powerful, wonderful person in the world? You could say that's kind of like a description of Elon Musk. Okay. Now, there's also the mission-driven asshole. And the mission-driven asshole, it's not about him or her. It's about their mission. And I believe Steve Jobs is the ultimate mission-driven asshole because he was driven to make the best computer possible and democratize computing, making people more creative and productive. And nothing was going to stand in his way. Not incompetent people, not industry standards, not, you know, conventional in-the-box ways of thinking. And so Steve Jobs, for all the negative things you've heard about him, I think he was absolutely a remarkable leader. He changed my life. I would not be on your podcast today were it not for Steve Jobs. So the message I have for you is, you know what, like, if you have to be an asshole, which is debatable, we can debate that too. But if you have to be an asshole, be a mission-driven asshole. So it's not about you. It's about the mission of your organization. Now, to address the earlier part of what I just said, I don't think it's necessary to be an asshole to be successful. And I cite for you one of the people who just personifies the anti-asshole mission-driven CEO, which is Melanie Perkins of Canva. She is the least assholeness of leaders ever. And she's enormously successful. Canva is so successful that I'm the chief evangelist of the company. So, you know, listen, I have a conflict of interest there, but I'm telling you from the outside looking in, having worked for Steve Jobs and Melanie Perkins, and nobody else in the world can say that. I'm telling you that she is a remarkable, not asshole CEO.
So which path is that? So the 9 paths that you have, which path is that?
That path is grace.
Grace.
Right? Okay, let's talk about grace, and let's talk about Jobs. And I hope you don't mind me revealing this to our audience. I don't think you would mind, but come August, Guy, you're going to be 70 years old. Guy Kawasaki doesn't need to work. For those of you listening in, Guy doesn't have to give a shit anymore. At all. So he's had many chapters in his life and career, and they've all been remarkable. So my question to you is, why are you giving back more now than arguably any other time in your life and career? Why are you grinding it out? Why are you 250 podcasts, 5,000 word transcripts, you know, hundreds of podcasts where you're a guest launching your 16th book? Like, okay, you're okay. Working very hard.
You are working.
Why? How?
Listen, you need to be aware of unintended consequences. Like, what if you ask that question and it sparks a realization in me that I should stop doing this? Why are you doing this, Guy?
That is not my intention. We've got 5 million people waiting for your wisdom.
So listen, okay, I love tricolons, and I figured out that life is a tricolon. So in the first third of your life, you're underpaid and you're overworked. The second third of your life,
I agree,
you're underworked and you're overpaid. And in the third third of your life, if you aspire to be remarkable, then you realize it's about paying back. So I am in the phase of my life where my goal is to pay back. And I want to be remembered when I die for helping people make a difference, that I empowered them. So that's my goal in life. That's my ikigai. And I think it's because I've realized that, you know, yes, you know, a lot of it is about your efforts and your grit and your growth. But ultimately, for every successful person, there are a lot of people and a lot of things that fell in line. Some of it is luck, but some of it is a sixth grade teacher back in Kalihi Valley who convinced my parents to put me into a private school, that got me into Stanford, that got me to Mike Boyce, that got me to Apple, and the rest is history, right? So no one ever knows her name. Her name is Trudy Akau. So she did that. And then some college counselor at my high school, Iolani, I don't know why, convinced me to apply to Stanford. I got in. I mean, I am so old that when I applied to Stanford, being Japanese American, it was considered, you know, an oppressed minority. So I got lower standards to get in. Now, if you're Japanese American, you have higher standards to get in. That's how far the world has come. And so I've realized that, you know, it was a teacher, it was this coach, it was this English teacher in high school, it was this first boss, Steve Jobs. It was, you know, a lot of people gave me breaks. So the fact that I am where I am, it's not just because I'm such an awesome person, which is debatable. A lot of things had to fall in place. So I believe in this concept of both noblesse oblige, that, you know, there's an obligation, but I also believe something slightly different, which is a success oblige. So when you are successful, you somehow got through an open door, and your moral obligation is to at least leave that door open, if not make that door bigger. Because at the end of your life, you know, you don't want people to remember you because there's a big building at Stanford with your name on it. There will never be a building at Stanford with my name on it, because any university with $60 billion doesn't need my money. I would give it to the California community colleges and the Cal State, you know, colleges, right? Not Stanford. And so that's how I want to be remembered, not with a building, not because, you know, I outed Harvard presidents who may have plagiarized something. I mean, you know, yeah, that's not my goal in life. I mean, you know, now that we've cured climate change and crime and, you know, human rights and we've taken care of the Middle East, now that we took care of everything, finally, I can address the big threats to society. Plagiarism 30 years ago, that's my calling. That's my ikigai.
Yeah, thank you for reminding us that net worth doesn't mean grace.
No, any it doesn't.
Any one of us can choose to pay back and give. And again, you live these words. For those of us who've been in your orbit, know it. Even you if know, you don't know it, even you, I bet you had no idea that you helped me land at Salesforce, but you did. So thank you for that. Go ahead, Ray.
Now I'm expecting a speaking invitation to Dreamforce now. Okay, so.
I can make that happen. All right. if that's my tiny way of giving back, done.
Okay, my deal there is one copy for everybody who went to Dreamforce. I don't need money.
I gotta save this. Mission Connected Enterprise, October 28th. Oh my God, you're gonna be busy.
thank you for living a recommendable and remarkable life. Truly, it's an honor to learn from you.
Val, 10 years ago, whenever I said yes to you being your first guest, I had already planned this all out. I said, you know, someday, guy, you're going to write a book and you're going to want him to like get everybody at Salesforce to buy a copy. And then he's going to have this conference in Half Moon Bay. And, you know, you don't have to pay for the Ritz-Carlton guy. Now you can go stay there free. And like, you know, you can listen to the guy playing the bagpipes at night and sit at that outdoor gas barbecue.
I totally believe if there's one person that can connect the dots forward, it's you. There's always an exception to Steve Jobs' wisdom. There's always an exception.
Yeah, you know, listen. I have some beachfront property in Arizona I can sell you too, so whatever.
Just add water?
Just add water. That's right.
We're here with
congratulations on the book.
The OG, out with Think Remarkable, 9 paths to transform your life and make a difference. Follow him on X at Guy Kawasaki. And of course, grab his book at Amazon and maybe see him at Dreamforce and see him in October. Thanks for being on the show.
I want you to plainly say that you read that book and you think it's really useful and you want your listeners to. Let's just get that out on you. No, I'm not holding a gun to your head. You don't have to say it if you don't want to, but I'm not speaking for you if you don't. But anyways.
It's an international best-selling book that anybody will benefit from. And I love, it's a playbook, folks that are listening. It's got titles, subtitles, 88 tactics. Literally, you can go no more than 2 pages and you know how to do something actionable. And Guy starts every bullet with action verbs. Like he's super deliberate about what he's writing. Believe you me, it's going to be a book you're not going to be able to put down. Anyway, that's my one set.
It is a mind shift. It's a mind shift.
Just tell me how you really feel.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Okay, boys. Have a great weekend. Thank you so much. All the best. Well. And see you in October.
See you in October.
Looking forward to it.
Send me an email. You can send me an email because I'm going to forget. We got to get this on my calendar.
We'll get this on your calendar. We'll send it to Fortier and we'll send it direct to you. We can find
okay.
It.
All right. Thank you. Bye bye.
Thank you. Bye bye.
You know, sometimes people throw out OG, but he is the OG evangelist. Like when I was offered in 2015 to join Salesforce as an evangelist, there's only one name I could think of, and it was Guy. And I just remember the Mac coming to market mid 80s, him going back as an Apple fellow in the 90s. Okay. So this is our cleanup hitter spot, where somebody comes in and hits a grand slam to finish. Yeah.
He's tough to follow, guys.
Yeah, but you can do it because you're an exceptional CEO. Mike Southward, CEO of Babel Street. Thank you, sir. Babel Street provides the most advanced data analytics and intelligence platform for the world's most trusted government and commercial organizations. Leading organization count on AI powered Babel Street Insights platform risks and maximize outcomes. Michael's an executive leader with deep experience building multinational private and public companies through growth, acquisition, and business transformation. Michael's a Silicon Valley native with strong technology roots. Today's been all about that, folks with Silicon Valley background and business orientation. We focus on building teams, expanding addressable markets, strategic planning, execution, operational efficiency, and more. Michael serves on a number of boards, both public and nonprofit businesses. Welcome, Michael, to Disrupt TV.
Yeah, it's really nice to meet you guys.
Great to meet you,
sir. We're excited to have you here, right? And you're looking at a very, very interesting OSINT. We'll talk about what that is. You can explain it to everyone. But in this age of AI, people are looking for sources. They're looking for signals. They're trying to bring all that stuff back to life. And many times their data is old. Their data has decay, right? The framework that you guys have in OSINT is actually very powerful for the situations that you guys use it for, but it's also something that could be applied in the commercial world as well. So talk about OSINT, the framework, and more importantly, you know, that's you know how it all got started.
Open source intelligence, for those of you listening.
Go ahead, sure. So let's talk about that. Open source intelligence leverages publicly available information, as you guys know, to make more informed and timely decisions. Pretty simple. We do that every day, right? We're on Google, on a personal, and we're doing research around that. But OSINT typically does that at an industrial scale. And unlike a typical Google search, you're pulling information back from all sorts of sources that are non-English, because most of digital traffic is in non-English sources. I assume most of your audience are English speakers around that. Deep and dark web, social media, collaboration sites. So if you really want to understand the full topic of something, that's a typical good way of doing that. And OSINT, or open source intelligence, has some national security implications, connotations. So like, it's aligned with geospatial intelligence and human intelligence, signal intelligence in these areas. So, but there's a number of business applications for it as well. Competitive intelligence uses OSINT platforms, brand protection. Alt data and financial services is a really popular use case, as well as just investigations and situational awareness.
And there's also malicious file analysis, your ability to actually know when someone's trying to pump, you know, junk into the system and confuse the signals too, right?
So. Yeah, it's really hard. With generative AI today, it's, you know, upwards of 10% of digital traffic is malicious. And that's happening. It's pretty incredible. So, you know, over 300 million terabytes of data populates on a daily basis today, and a good chunk of that is malicious, as you say. So, you know, there's a couple ways of thinking about that. One is to accept that that's the world we live in today, and to understand the origins of that. With that understanding, who, what, and the why, we can inform the public in a much more, you know, robust way than is done today. There's also ways to analyze the traffic. You know, humans speak and act in more typical ways than a bot. Like, you know, if you think about your profile, you're connected to a number of people, you speak just like your guests on a number of different topics, right? You're alive, right? And bots' profiles tend to be very immature. They tend to be very focused on one or two topics, Ukraine, you know, different China things, politics, you know, these things just get hammered. And so you can do a lot of statistical analysis. You can do some knowledge graphing to understand, you know, whether someone is it's a proof of life type of analysis on things that are live. But we do need to understand that this is the world that we live in, and there's going to be a significant amount of this traffic as we move forward.
Michael, you've been the CEO at Babel Street for 2 years running. You mentioned generative AI. You know, October of 2022, most of the world woke up to this incredible technology. 59 days later, 100 million users of generative AI. So certainly in your 2 year tenure, you as a CEO, certainly you recognize the great awareness of this capability and technology. But what are some of the things that you've learned on the job? You're not a first time CEO. So what have you learned that you can share with other CEOs and folks who are, you know, in the technology space, trying to better understand signals to make more informed decisions and ultimately improve their execution velocity?
Yeah, great question. Look, I'm on the back nine of my career, I guess. I'm 51 years old, and certainly the world is different, you know, when
oh, that's not the back nine. That's not the back nine.
That's not the back nine. Come on, guy is 70 in a few
yeah, guy's
months.
On the back nine.
That's pretty incredible. Let's
yeah, be clear.
I hope you have that much energy.
You're not in the third inning, third or fourth inning.
Look, I think everyone needs to have a growth mindset, that continuous learning happens every single day. And I think when you stop learning, I guess you really start dying at this point. So as it relates to CEO, you know, if I'm going to be specific on Babel Street, we've acquired a couple companies lately. And I guess throughout my career, I've been maybe part of 40 or so transactions. And, you know, along those lines, on the transaction side, you know, I think, you know, you learn from mistakes as you go through it. And a lot of those learnings are things that you sort of should have picked up in kindergarten. And so if I'm looking at, you know, specifically on M&A side of things, you know, I'm probably more focused on the people side than I ever have been. It's probably something I didn't appreciate as much on my 30s and even my 40s. You know, we had a deal that we did that was a really great fit from a strategy perspective, but from a culture perspective, we knew we were going to have some challenges. And then the first week, I did one-on-ones with, it was a small transaction, but it still had 100 people where you walk through, and I did 20 minute one-on-ones with all 100 people in that week. And it's making sure that, you know, they know that they're valued and that they have a great role in that new company. You know, that transparency now and the consistency in communication, especially with the remoteness of employees today, is probably more important, because it's harder to walk by everyone's office every day and to do that management by sort of walk by around that. And so we meet as a business every Thursday. We go through sort of different functional brief outs. So every function does it once or twice a particular quarter. So if you're a new employee and you start on January 1st, you've gone through all the functional areas, you know, by the end of the quarter in 13 weeks. And just having that sort of open conversation, open dialogue with employees, I think has been pretty effective on that side. So again, things I didn't think about going forward, pretty simple things like overall, but they've, you know, they help, because if you can get 10% additional engagement, if you could really focus on the purpose, the why of what you're building, then people will lean in and certainly they're happier, but also, you know, I think you accomplish a lot more as a business. So we talk because our missions are so much on catching bad guys and doing really good things, whether it's for US government or any money laundering use cases. You know, it's really trying to showcase those use cases to the employees to get excited about what we do in the marketplace.
Michael, that's an example of what we just heard from Guy of grace. You talk about growth mindset. Guy talked about growth, having grit, and now grace. A CEO meeting one-on-one with all 100 people of a company, I'm pretty sure folks 90 to 100 didn't think they were going to meet with the CEO. I've been part of a number of acquisitions. I've never heard of a CEO having one-on-one meetings with the entire company that's acquired. So that is grace to me. So thank you for reminding us that some kindergarten lessons we should hold on dearly throughout our careers.
Yeah, no question. And you learn, right? You learn what's really going on. I think as CEO, I mean, we're still a relatively small company, less than 500 people, but you learn from throughout the organization. And you know, as CEO, you're not necessarily paid for your ideas, right? You're paid for making the business perform and engaging people. And if you can accomplish that, you're usually in pretty good shape.
That's a good point. And I think, you know, as everybody's looking at that, I mean, that's the type of leadership that people want. It's authentic, right? It's in person, it's connected. That's where organizations are headed. You mentioned something earlier, really about what's going on with, you know, some of the threats that are out there. A big one is misinformation, disinformation. We are, you know, probably, you know, a couple hundred days away from an election, and, you know, 53% of the world is actually and has been voting for their elected leader this year. So it's a really big number, and we're seeing massive amounts of misinformation and disinformation. Where can you use OSINT to actually do or apply that to actually combat this misinformation, disinformation that's going on, especially in an age of generative AI?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a number of companies. And if you look at OSINT overall, it's not just one thing. You know, like, again, when I grew up, you know, in the Bay Area, there was the San Francisco Chronicle, there was the San Jose Mercury News, right? And there were three major networks at that point. You know, today, information is highly fragmented. And if you're an average 30-year-old, you're getting a majority of your information from social media. And so if you look at it from that perspective, it's really challenging, because information is so fragmented today, and people identify with a particular group and it becomes an echo chamber on that group. So, you know, how open source information can help with that is typically in sort of bulk analysis and looking at abnormality detection around that. And I said, like, it won't combat, you know, from an AI perspective, you can detect bots to some degree, and companies have had some success. Babel Street isn't in on that side of the fence, but I think even the understanding that there's influence campaigns out there, whether they're state sponsored or more local sponsored, on almost every hot button topic, whether it's Ukraine or issues in China, certainly Russia, US politics is a high one on there, and make sure that within those groups that you understand that abnormality detection, if there's artificial changes in increases, that we identify it. And I think the US government today is doing a much better job in terms of understanding it. It's not as publicized in terms of, you know, the understanding of who's influencing and why they're influencing it. I'd love to see that more reported in the general press. To your question in terms of how OSINT can do that, I think it's really around the analytics using AI and ML for those capabilities and doing that. But to the extent today, there is no national police on validity of data. There's some great nonprofits out there that are working on it. Trust and Media Cooperative is a good nonprofit that's working on verifying, you know, particular sources and sources in that area. But this is a huge challenge across the board that extends well beyond open source information and open source intelligence.
And Michael, future of OSINT, you've mentioned generative AI, you mentioned machine learning. Where do you see the future of OSINT shaping, you know, how businesses deal with analytics and data and information?
Yeah, on the easy side of things, you know, as information changes, like moving from text to image, from image to video, OSINT.
Multimodal. Yeah,
100%. You know, I mean, 10 years ago, most things were in text. Now, even how we consume, I imagine how you guys consume information is much more video and image basis. And so that changes the tools required to analyze it, and it becomes much more complex. But in the broader sense, I think, you know, the AI has a role in being able to analyze that. If you're creating 300 million terabytes of data a day, you know, you can, there's not a company in the world or a government in the world that can hire enough folks to effectively analyze that information. And so if you sort of go below that, I believe, and really why I'm here at Babel Street, is that there's the ability to automate a lot of these investigations. I mean, looking back to our own lives, you know, and I use the example of you know, when a banking transaction for me 30 years ago or 40 years ago was walking into the bank, right, and giving your passport over to the teller where they would stamp it for a deposit, and that moved to a vacuum tube and moved to an ATM and moved to a mobile app, and now even when someone sends me a check, right, that even though it takes only 1 second to click it into the mobile app, you're asking why didn't they use PayPal or Venmo or one of the other services out there? So that automation didn't happen naturally; it happened through investment, and those transactions actually got more secure, not less secure, through that process. And largely, the transactions that we focus on are manual transactions, individual or identity investigations today, whether it's a large bank or government screening process, border control, are very manual. And a lot of those can be automated with technology to a higher degree of accuracy. And that's really where I see leveraging open source information to really understand the full digital profile of someone or some entity, and then automating that analysis in a way where if and when you have the human in the loop, they're just focusing on the knowledge work, not the going, you know, 10 pages deep on Google or other services.
Yeah. And you said if you have the human in the loop. So are we entering like a machine-led, human assisted if necessary?
Yeah, and everyone's at a different stage in that journey, right? If you propose that to a national security agency today, they would throw you out of their office in some cases.
Yeah.
in a financial services, that may be very receptive, who may be further along on that
journey. Hyper-automation.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think you need to sort of understand where people are on the journey. And I think that the end state is well understood. And I think it's a question of gaining the confidence and the reliability to get there. And it's complicated. There's north of 100 languages that need to be analyzed. And obviously it's multimedia. To do this and to do it accurately is a challenge. It's why we're in business and a number of other companies like us.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at when and where you insert a human, it's going to be the most important design point. The automation is going to be assumed as you start going forward. Now, I want to actually understand the market. You guys are on a massive M&A spree. And what I mean by that is there are a lot of small players that you're actually consolidating now, able to deliver at scale. Talk about the strategy behind that and the backing behind it, because it sounds like you see a bigger market than the TAM that's currently listed by the existing players, and you're working to a bigger vision. So talk about that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look at our own lives today. You know, they're more digital than they ever have been. And that's true in business as well. You know, if you think of a normal software sales, you know, I understand, you know, more than 60% of the sales cycle actually happens before they talk to an actual account executive in that.
Easily.
Think about how that's changed, you know, over the past. So, you know, we believe in the power of leveraging open source information to make better decisions. And to do that requires certainly the capacity to be able to source a lot more data feeds and a lot of those in hard to reach places and non-English sources for better decisions. And so we, you know, in our world, we're at early innings in this market, and there's a consolidation and there's a growth play, and we have a great sponsor, financial sponsor for us to do that. Whenever you think you're in the early innings, it's time to invest. And that's exactly what we're doing.
Yeah, no, we're definitely seeing that in this marketplace. Oh, sorry, Val, go ahead.
My last question, anytime we have successful CEOs on our show, I know there are other CEOs who are truly in the first and second inning of their career. Any advice to CEOs you can share based on 2 years of running a successful company, doing big things like acquisitions? What advice do you have to, and I know, think about kindergarten, be kind, be graceful, be accessible, be honest, be empathetic. But is there something that unique to your experience you can share with other CEOs?
Yeah, I mean, all my mistakes, I guess. If I was going to write a book, I just write that.
Some of the best CEOs I know, they make a ton of original mistakes, meaning they don't repeat the same mistake.
Yeah. Look, I find it much easier to be authentic today, and maybe I learned that too late in my career, you know, in that piece, you know, around that. But I, you know, yeah, for better or worse, I think at this stage, I'm definitely am, and I would encourage people to be who they are, exactly, because there's no like perfect script for any CEO. It's a super humbling job. You know, no one calls me and says, great job, Michael. You really hit it out of the park today. That call does happen 0 out of 0%. And so what I do get is plenty of constructive feedback. And so, you know, you either learn from those and continue to evolve and communicate to the company, or you said, you know, you sort of turn the light out. So that's one, at least for me personally, but that's one that probably reflects my own limitations. The other one is probably just being able to say no. You know, most of management is actually saying no to things and really staying focused for us. You know, we believe as the market changes, you know, there's gonna be more advanced use cases and counterparty risks and identity that can leverage this information, essentially using 21st century tools, you know, versus 20th century tools for the problems. I mean, the amount of fraud, waste and abuse and identity issues is a huge challenge. And so for us, that means saying no to some other work that we have in front of us. And those are super hard decisions, and there's no easy way around that. But when you have that 50-50 call, it's one that we have to make, you know, and that's
for sure, for sure.
Endless amount of resources. My Apple friend told me, you know, I asked him what his biggest challenges, and he said resources. And I said, how can that be? Work for Apple. How could resources be it? But every company out there has resources challenges, whether it's big Apple or relatively small company.
I'm sure this isn't the first time you heard this today or this week, but Michael, you did a great job. You did great.
Thank you, guys.
And I mean that. We totally mean that. Go ahead, Ray.
Thanks. We got Michael Southworth, CEO of Babbel Street. You can follow him at Twitter at Babbel Knowledge. Thank you so much for being on the show, and happy Friday.
I really enjoyed it.
Take care, Michael.
Guys. All right.
I love learning from smart CEOs. You know, we truly get it remarkable. When I look at the roster of 1,300 interviews, and so many remarkable CEOs, and I'm using the word remarkable specifically because they all think remarkable. Ray, wrap up the show, please, and do it in 30 seconds. And I know that's hard to do because Guy and Michael drop lots of nuggets of wisdom.
Treat everyone with respect, especially your intern. No, I think we got a lot of knowledge, and it's really great. I mean, as we work through your careers, and as you're in different places of your careers, definitely give back. I think, you know, there's stories on paths to success and being remarkable. It's just one way of guy giving back, but everybody has an ability to do that on their own. So definitely do that. What we see here with OSINT and Michael, I think is really important. People are looking at way security models work to actually gain intelligence. When we're looking in an AI world, we are going to run out of data, and your ability to actually master signals and bring signals in and make sense of them really drives this data to decisions capability in the age of AI. So we're going to see a lot more of that over time. And then I think that's going to be very important for every organization to know how to master bringing those signals. The OSINT framework is actually a very, very powerful open source framework. And companies that know how to do that are doing it in security, but they can also do it for competitive intelligence.
That's amazing. Amazing summary. Okay, next Friday, episode 361, we have Eric Best, co-founder and CEO of Sound Commerce. We have Kunal Agarwal, CEO of Dope.Security. And we have Maisie Gansler, Chief Strategy and Brand Officer at Bon Appetit Management Company and author of You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime and Other Lessons from Food Industry for Creating a More Sustainable Company. That may be the coolest title. You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime. I love that. If it's Friday, it's Disrupt TV. Thank you all for watching. We'll see you next week. Bye, everyone.
Bye.